It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Alvin Ailey, Misty Copeland, Gregory Hines, Catherine Dunham, just a few of the many Black dancers and choreographers who have had a tremendous impact on the history of American dance. Point Park University is celebrating the accomplishments of many of these artists during Black History Month. Garfield Lemonius is the chair of dance at Point Park. Welcome back to the program, Garfield.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
And on the line is dance historian and author Brenda Dixon Goshield, who will visit Pittsburgh and give a talk at the Pittsburgh Playhouse Friday evening at 7. Brenda, welcome.
Thank you.
Most people can agree that dancers of color have had an important role in the evolution of the art form. What are some of the tangible impacts you're trying to teach your students, relay to others? Brenda, let's start with you.
Okay. And as a professor emerita from Temple University and having written several books, all of which deal with the what I call invisibilized Africanist presence in American performance, I am in the business of, if you will, bringing to the fore something that's part of the actual earth and soil and air that we breathe, that because of American and global racism, actually, has been hidden from view. So when we talk about the influence of dancers of color, or to be specific, dancers of the African diaspora, what we're talking about is a very basic integer in the development of what we even see and think of as quote-unquote traditional, meaning white, mm-hmm. American dance.
Garfield?
Point Park University has a very diverse student body, and within that diversity, our dance program also have many dancers of color. So it's important for us to know that they're represented in the curriculum. So teaching them about the impact and the many contributions that African Americans have played in the story of American dance was essential to us.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, you mentioned visibility, or what are some of the less visible contributions that you've studied and you wish more people knew about?
I wish people understood that what we think of as American culture is, in essence, African, European, American culture. So the way we think, even the way in which we have an attitude of quote-unquote coolness, or the way we, and when I say we now, I mean all Americans of all ethnicities, that basic integers that we understand as being part of America come out of African-American roots. So it's more than just influences. I mean, we're part of the soil that makes what we are and who we are, who we are.
Is there a definitive period where you think Black dance, in America specifically, took the reins and sort of pushed the envelope forward? Garfield, let's start with you on that one.
That's a very good question. I think Black dancers have always been there. And because representation has not been a part of the curriculum in study right. of dance history, it seems right. as if Black dancers haven't been a part of that process. But Black dancers have been there from the very get-go, from the very beginning. And that's why representation is so important, not only the curriculum, but in terms of the dancers that we see in professional dance companies.
Brenda?
And if you would go a little further, this very interesting study that was recently done by the New York Times, the 1619 Project, goes deeply into those roots, beginning with slavery. Already there was exchange of ways of moving and speaking and talking, the way in which dances came out of the African-American experience on the plantation, the way in which blackface minstrelsy came about from Thomas Daddy Rice, a grade B, if you will, vaudeville performer, who, seeing an African-American servant do a strange little dance outside of a restaurant, He picks up on that dance. Stories are that he bought the that old man's clothing or imitated it, blacked up, and did this dance. Early on, this kind of appropriation or stealing, if you will, of African-American ways of moving, styles. The cakewalk, which it then is an example of African-American enslaved people imitating the plantation owners, but taking it to an ironic level, which the plantation owners didn't understand was a joke on them, and then they borrowing the same cakewalk style, and the cakewalk becomes a very important dance of the turn of the into the turn of the 20th century. There's stories like that that go on with the cakewalk, the black bottom, the Charleston, all of these dances, the Lindy Hop, the hip hop dances, the monkey, the horse, all of the dances of the 1960s, up until, of course, here we are now. And these things, of course, don't remain only as popular entertainment forms. They also seep into the concert dance arenas as well. So again, Kevin, it's part of the process. It's just deeply embedded in how we move and what our culture is really about.
What about the music? How has that pushed the art, changed it over time? For instance, I mean, hip hop, it's developed over the last 30 years with dances mm-hmm. that often find themselves, their origins in African dance specifically. Garfield, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a very, very good question, because there seems to be a separation that music, there is black music and then there's white music. But as Brenda was saying before, Dr. B was saying before, it is a part of the fabric of American culture that you have European culture and American culture joining together to create, African-American culture that is, joining together to create an American cultural identity.
Yes.
And American cultural identity is informed by the different peoples in the country, African peoples, black people, and certainly European peoples.
Mm-hmm. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the art and evolution of black dance. Garfield, why is it important for your students to see themselves reflected in the lesson plan?
It is important because, as I said before, representation matters. And the body, as Dr. B likes to say, tells us what is valued in a culture. Dancers, when they go to a performance and see a performance, they're looking at the bodies, certainly the repertoire, but they're also looking at the bodies on stage. And the bodies on stage defines the aesthetics of that particular company. So if they go to a ballet company performance and they too want to become ballet dancers and they do not see themselves represented on stage, they feel that this is not the kind of field that I can succeed in. So that's why for us it's so important that in the curriculum, we establish a mainstay of all peoples.
Right. Brenda, I want to ask you, of course, I believe your latest book is Joan Myers Brown and the Audacious Hope of the Black Ballerina. Brown, of course, the founder of the Philadelphia Dance Company, Philadanko. Two words in that title stand out to me. Audacious hope. Audacious hope. Now,
yes.
Was it because of the obstacles? I mean, as Garfield alluded to, how often are ballerinas of color cast for roles now that have for so long been given to white dancers?
Okay, Kevin, just to point out that that phrase, audacious hope, is taken from the second book by our president, Barack Obama, which was called his second book, called Audacious Hope. And I was so intrigued by that title that I borrowed that because, of course, it was and still is an audacious hope of ballerinas of color to be understood as part of a tradition that we are not separate. And what the book does, Kevin, is traces back before Joan Myers Brown to a woman by the name of Essie Marie Dorsey in the 1920s, who brought ballet and ballet studies to the Black community in Philadelphia. And it's interesting because what it tells us is that ballet was being developed in Black communities, not just Philly, in the USA, around the same time that Americans were beginning to think about ballet at all, about the time that soon after Balanchine came to the USA. He was an immigrant from Russia, by the way. So the audacious hope is that, you know, we've been doing this, in other words, is being said. We've been doing this for the same amount of time that white companies have been and studios have been offering ballet. But it is still our hope, and it seems audacious, that we will become recognized for what it is that we're doing.
Our guest on The Confluence, our Garfield Lemonius Chair of Dance at Point Park University, and dance historian Brenda Dixon Goshield. Garfield, when you are teaching your students and teaching them, helping them grow in the art form, are you also addressing, talking about the obstacles for dancers of color?
We do. Mm-hmm. We certainly, in our curriculum, we have a fabulous dance historian, Dr. Colleen Hooper, who was very instrumental in helping us bring Dr. B to Point Park. And we reflect on the curriculum that we currently have and what is missing, and reflect on our student body, what they need to become successful artists, to become critical thinkers, creative thinkers, problem solvers. So it's important that however we're impacting them, we're giving them the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So whether it is in the studio or in our theory-based classes or survey classes, we try to inform the students on an inclusive education of dance.
Is there a physical benefit to focusing on some of the techniques used more commonly in, say, Afro-Brazilian culture, maybe even hip-hop?
It's so important, so essential, because dance is a universal language, as well as is music. So the body can be educated to move differently. The body, ballet is not specific to only one type of body. African dance is not specific to one type of body. Dancers can be taught how to move differently. And so for us, if we're training our dancers to become versatile movers, it's important for us that they do African dance, ballet, jazz, and various styles of modern dance.
Brenda, for your books, you have interviewed many of the greatest Black dancers and choreographers. In general, do they feel like they've gotten their just due, the recognition they deserve?
No. No, I mean, this is why there is such a discipline now called race studies. And also dance studies and performance studies, because in those studies, which look at the socio-political basis of performance, what we see are the issues in society, the political and economic and cultural issues that have made our nation indeed a nation of inequality, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I do definitely mean racial inequality.
Right.
So no, our dancers certainly recognize that, and including the white dancers as well. So it's not as though those people that I've interviewed, and I would think the people in the dance departments that people like Garfield and other dance departments are nurturing, I think people are quite aware of these issues.
Brenda, talking to these wonderful artists, what is it like for you when you visit with young, aspiring dancers, hoping to literally follow in their footsteps?
It's just a delight for me to be with young people. I used to teach dance years ago in a nursery school. So that's how much movement and being with young people means to me. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with the undergrad and graduate students at Point Park. And of course, I'm really looking forward to an audience members of adults and elders like myself. It's relevant to everybody. And I mean, there's this thing I used to have on my desk, you know, if you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing. You know, it's a universal language, and I love sharing it and sharing what I do with other people.
Garfield, finally to you, how will understanding history help your students in their growth as dancers?
They'll become more critically aware of the environment that they're in, of society, political views, their own views. And by doing so, they can become tomorrow's problem solvers. And that's what's so important about arts education. It is preparing young artists not just to be skilled movers, but also to be problem solvers, critical thinkers, and giving them the skills that they can transfer to other areas in the industry beyond dance.
Garfield Lemonius is the chair of dance at Point Park University. Dance historian and author Brenda Dixon Goshield will speak at the Pittsburgh Playhouse Friday evening at 7 about the impact of Black dancers on the history of American dance. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, a look at the balancing act performed by Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf between supporting petrochemicals and meeting ambitious climate goals for the state. Plus, a look at the future of farming in Pennsylvania with shrinking farmland and aging farmers. Then, Airbnb is a growing sector of Pittsburgh's hospitality industry, often offering cheaper prices on larger spaces. Coming up, a conversation about how the local hotel industry is taking notice. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Fleetwood Mac released their landmark album Rumors on this day in 1977. Though the album sounds amazing, it's hard not to think about the miserable time the band were having while making it. Christine and John McVie were splitting up while Lindsey Buckingham was losing Stevie Nicks to the band's namesake, Mick Fleetwood. Oof. As painful as it may have been to sing miserable songs written about each other, the Mac nailed it, creating a truly legendary album that sold over 40 million copies. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In his second term, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf has set ambitious climate goals for the state, but he's also embraced the carbon-emitting petrochemical industry. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looks at the governor's tightrope on climate.
Since his second term began last year, there's been a theme for Tom Wolf's tenure as Pennsylvania governor: climate change. Here he is last year talking about climate-related floods that have recently hit Pennsylvania.
That's affected our farmers and the crops that they grow. It's devastated homes. This is affecting all of our lives each and every day.
Wolf made the remarks while announcing a goal of 80% carbon reductions in the state by 2050, the first of its kind. Since then, Wolf has followed that up with plans to join regional initiatives to reduce carbon from the transportation and electricity sectors. These steps pleased many in the environmental community, including Joe Minot of the Clean Air Council.
He understands climate change, believes that it is already having an impact on Pennsylvania, and is proposing to address it.
While Minot says Wolf deserves praise, there is a but. Wolf supports Shell's Beaver County ethane cracker, a massive plant that will turn natural gas into plastic pellets. Here he is in 2016.
And if the cracker plant works and does what I think it's going to do, and we do what we need to do with the education and transportation and all the other infrastructure, then these jobs are going to be here.
Along with jobs, Minot says the ethane cracker will bring something else, a big carbon footprint, which will counteract Wolf's own climate goals. For one, it will further entrench natural gas in the state's economy. Though it produces less CO2 than coal and has helped the state lower its greenhouse gas output in recent years, natural gas wells can leak the potent greenhouse gas methane into the atmosphere. And
the petrochemical plant itself is a humongous emitter of greenhouse gases.
The Beaver County plant is permitted to emit more than 2 million tons of carbon dioxide, the equivalent CO2 of 400,000 more cars on the road. Leah Stokes of the University of California, Santa Barbara, says promoting any new fossil fuels at this point, even natural gas, could tip the world over the edge of climate catastrophe by mid-century.
What the modeling shows is that if we want to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which many consider a sort of safe warming level, if we want to do that, we cannot build any new fossil fuel infrastructure.
But Wolf has maintained that natural gas, while not perfect, can be done better. He's proposed a severance tax on gas and rules to limit methane leaks at wells and tightening other drilling regulations. The governor's spokesman, J.J. Abbott, says Wolf's been hemmed in by a GOP legislature that wants fewer rules on oil and gas, not more.
And I believe the governor has been a backstop against some of the even, the proposals that would reduce our ability to hold the industry accountable to high environmental standards.
Wolf's stance on the industry has placated the state's biggest trade unions, a major source of support in his own Democratic Party. Jeff Nobers of the Builders Guild of Western Pennsylvania said Wolf's pragmatic approach is better for unions in Pennsylvania than that taken by Democratic presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who've both called for a ban on fracking.
You know, I think the governor is trying to take a very, middle of the road approach to this, ensuring certain things on one side while still being able to, take advantage of, if you will, and grow an industry and create jobs.
This strategy plays well in Pennsylvania, says Chris Borick, a political science professor at Muhlenberg College.
He's found a spot that I think aligns very well with Pennsylvania public opinion. He's never called for a moratorium on natural gas, but he's been strong in his proposals and demands for an extraction tax.
Borick thinks in a purple state like Pennsylvania, Wolf's balancing act might provide a blueprint for other Democrats to follow to win elections. That's because while voters are getting more concerned about climate, it's still not as important to them as other issues, like jobs. Reed Frazier, State Impact Pennsylvania.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Agriculture is Pennsylvania's number one industry, but it faces serious challenges. One is aging farmers. Pennsylvania has twice as many farmers over the retirement age than under 35. Another possibly larger issue is lost farmland. More than 400,000 acres have gone out of production in the state over the past several years. That's about 5% of all farmland in Pennsylvania. WITF's Rachel McDevitt takes a look at how those two issues are intertwined.
Opportunity.
How's like that?
All right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, perfect. Let's go.
This year's Pennsylvania Farm Show was designed to highlight agricultural opportunities for young people who are interested or might become interested in the industry. But State Agriculture Secretary Russell Redding says he sees the challenges, too.
Yeah, it is ever-present, this issue of transition.
Redding says there are two questions wrapped up in that issue. How do you get land held by the older generation to younger ones, and who do you bring in to farm? Let's start with the who.
Welcome to Midwinter Convention!
At the farm show, the Pennsylvania Future Farmers of America held a convention to recognize achievements among its members and welcome new participants. There were hundreds of students, all with some kind of passion for agriculture.
You go to fill up your car with gas, that's agriculture. You go to the store to buy milk, that's agriculture. You wake up and drink a cup of coffee, that's agriculture.
18-year-old Emma Musser of Lancaster County says more needs to be done to educate the general public about how agriculture touches their lives. She hopes to someday own a farm and raise pigs. But not all of Musser's peers in FFA are future farmers. They might be researchers or business owners or teachers. The organization encourages that, and agriculture boosters say those jobs are needed. But those who do go into production agriculture will have to find land to work on. So how can these young farmers find land? It can be especially challenging to those who don't come from farming families. Pennsylvania has some of the country's more expensive farmland, averaging $5,600 an acre. At Blue Mountain Farm in Dauphin County, Tyler Shaw says it's more cost-effective for farmers to rent farmland than own it. The 23-year-old originally got interested in agriculture through 4-H and helped his family turn their wooded lot into a small farm. He started renting more ground when he was in high school, first just trying to grow enough hay to feed his own animals, then expanding into a business.
Yep. Yeah, by the time I was 16, I had like 15 landlords. And
he now rents about 350 acres from 25 landlords, and he's hoping to buy a small farm of his own in the next few months. He says access to land is probably the biggest barrier a young farmer faces.
Land isn't something you can just go to the store and buy. And it's not, you can't go to the farm sale down the road this Saturday and, you know, purchase a lease agreement. That's not how it works.
Getting farmland, he says, takes relationships, time, and money. Shaw is hoping to take advantage of a new tax credit passed by the state legislature last year that will give an incentive to landowners to sell or rent farmland to young farmers, those who have been at it for less than 10 years. He says the credit should hopefully make a young farmer look a little more appealing than, say, a real estate developer.
Because it kind of gives us a little bit of an advantage that most of the time farmers don't have the advantage. So it kind of throws the ball in your court for once. So it's kind of exciting.
Many farmers do want to protect their land from development, and so some are turning to farmland preservation programs. It's one answer to the question of where people will be able to farm. Even Lancaster County, one of the top counties for preserved farmland nationally, has been losing about 1,200 acres annually for several years.
Yeah, this was in the meadow.
On the Shirk family farm in the county's Carnarvon Township, Paula Shirk and her daughter Beth lead the way through the snow over a wooden footbridge to the barn. Paula Shirk preserved the 56 acres last year through Lancaster Farmland Trust, a nonprofit that says it's seen interest in preservation grow recently. 50 farms are on its waiting list. Shirk's tenant, Lealan Neuschwanger, grew up across the road. He says if this land wasn't available to rent, he'd probably be looking for a place to buy out of state.
Farms in Lancaster County are very hard to get a hold of. They seem to bring top dollar.
Lancaster County is unique because while demand for farmland is strong thanks to a large population of Amish and Mennonite, it's also facing pressure from development.
Okay, you can go in the living room.
Inside the cozy farmhouse, seated around the dining room table, Beth Shirk says they've noticed development creeping in from nearby Morgantown. They can now see the glow of Walmart's lights peeking over the hills.
And the road even itself has turned from like a small back road to like, sometimes it seems like a major highway.
Shirk says she and her two sisters would like to see the farm kept as it is, but none of them want to take over.
I did genealogy for my husband's family. So these
Paula Shirk pages through a heavy binder and explains why she wanted to make sure this farm stayed just that. Her husband Robert's family has been on the land since 1792.
And for my husband, who wanted to continue that tradition and keep it in farm. The dirt's in his blood, you know.
After Robert's death in 2017, Shirk felt compelled to preserve the farm to honor him and his family's history.
It's like my gift to future generations, you know. It's like this is what we had in our life and we enjoyed and we were blessed to be here.
Even if the land is sold in the future, it can still only be used as farmland. Pennsylvania is a major grower of produce, such as mushrooms, apples, and peppers, and a big producer of eggs and dairy products. To keep its status, it will need to find answers to the who and where of future farming. Because looming over those questions, the Earth's population is expected to add another 2 billion people by the year 2050. To try to feed that population, farmers will need to grow more food on the same or less land. Rachel McDevitt, in Harrisburg.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The sharing economy has been growing over the last decade, and Pittsburgh has been no exception to the wave of sharing rides and sharing homes. Post-Gazette reporter Gretchen McKay joins us in studio to talk about how Airbnb is changing the game for local hoteliers. Gretchen, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for asking me, Kevin.
Airbnb lets homeowners rent out rooms, floors, their entire property through an online platform. You found that the number of travelers using the site in Pittsburgh has jumped over the last 5 years. Any indication as to why?
Well, I would speculate that it's because Airbnb is just, for a lot of travelers, it really hits the sweet spot. It gives you a bigger space. It's many times cheaper than staying in a hotel. And it puts you right in, the heartbeat of the city because you're in a neighborhood, which lets you experience the city you're visiting in a very different way than if you're in a big hotel downtown.
So here in Pittsburgh, who's the typical customer?
The typical customer apparently is somebody who's a little bit older. I guess seniors traveling with children. The grandparents is another popular segment that's growing in single women. But just anybody who wants to break out of the norm of, a boxy hotel room. Mm-hmm.
The consumers you spoke with, what do they see as the benefits over a traditional hotel room?
I'm sorry, the consumers or the hosts?
The consumers.
Well, as I mentioned, very often it's a better value for your dollar. You're going to get a space with a kitchen, maybe one or two bathrooms, sometimes a yard, and it's going to oftentimes have parking included, be close within walking distance to restaurants, bars, all kinds of attractions like that. So it's just, I just think it's a better value a lot of times for your money, but not always.
And investing that money sort of in the neighborhood, in the locality, as opposed to a hotel chain.
It does. A study by Airbnb showed that, almost half of the money that people spend with their travel dollars goes back into the community where the Airbnb is located.
You use the word value. So is it generally cheaper to book an Airbnb versus a stay at a hotel?
It can be. Visit Pittsburgh told me that the average cost of a hotel room in Pittsburgh currently is about $114 compared to $122 for Airbnb. But when you count in, you might have to book less rooms if you have a large family, or just the additional space that you get. I think it can be a real value.
We're talking to the Post-Gazette's Gretchen McKay about a surge in Airbnb use over the last few years. You found some remarkable numbers when it comes to what local hosts are earning in our region. More than $20 million made in 2019 alone, just here in Allegheny County. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that's right. Allegheny County had over 175,000 guest arrivals in 2019, and that generated over $20 million in income for the hosts who opened up their homes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a nice chunk of change.
So, logically, Allegheny County is number two in this state, but how does that compare to Philly, or if you prefer, even more rural areas?
Well, Philly has almost three times the amount of income from that, but of course they have three times the amount of people arriving because it's a much bigger city. But if you look at the next biggest one, it's Monroe County. It had about 18,000 or
Poconos.
18 million or yeah about 18 million dollars in for the hosts, and all the way down to Dauphin County, which only had a little under $3 million for the hosts. So it really depends upon where the Airbnb is located, what kinds of tourist attractions people are seeking out, and Pittsburgh ranks up there because we have so many things to do here.
And Dauphin County, of course, being the home
right
to Harrisburg. Overall, in the state, do we know much how the state is bringing in as a whole? Millions, millions.
Millions and millions, yes. They get, obviously you have to pay tax on your income and it goes to the local municipality, the city, and the state as well. And Airbnb has been collecting that since 2015, I'm told.
The added income, That sounds great. But you talked with some hosts who seemed to enjoy the experience as much as their guests.
Well, you get to meet people from all over the world coming to visit. And, you know, a lot of times people come back again and again. So you build relationships and friendships with your guests. And also what a homeowner's told me in the South Side who run out there home as an Airbnb, it really gets you connected to your city. You have to know about the things that are going on in the neighborhood and in the city at large so you can recommend things to your guests. So, you know, if there's a show coming up or, I don't know, a comedian's in town performing, you have to know that kind of stuff. And, you know, if you weren't renting your home out, you probably might not.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the typical customer. Who are the typical hosts, at least here locally?
I'm guessing they're people who want to earn a little bit extra income, who don't mind taking on the additional work that having an Airbnb requires, as far as, you know, filling the refrigerator for your guests or changing the sheets or just basically cleaning up. And also people who just, you know, want to have adventure.
Yeah, and
you got to be a people person, I'm guessing.
People person, yeah. But willing to put in the work to prepare your place.
Absolutely, because and a lot of these homes are not the homes that people live in. Although you can rent homes within, you know, somebody's house. A lot of them are, you know, investments or houses people are redoing. If you want people to come to your Airbnb and you want to be rated as a super host, you got to have something that's clean and attractive and has all the amenities that a traveler would want.
Reporter Gretchen McKay is our guest on The Confluence. Airbnb puts increased focus on experiences, sharing a meal at a local's house, private kayak lessons, that sort of thing. Are hoteliers keeping up with that? Seems like it goes beyond your typical concierge.
Well, you know, they have to, because I know that Airbnb only accounts for 2-3% of all hotel rentals. That's what Visit Pittsburgh told me. So it's not like it's huge competition, but any competition is competition, and we're all fighting for those travel dollars. So I know John Graff, who runs the Priory Group, he says that they have all kinds of concierge-style amenities that they offer, you know, with restaurant recommendations and special tours of activities and just things that make the guest feel loved and appreciated and the feeling that you're getting the best vacation you can when you stay there.
I have just a couple of minutes left. You find the majority, 70% of travelers, still opt for the traditional accommodations, like hotels, motels, bed and breakfast. But the industry is paying attention. How has this impacted maybe the overall competitiveness of the market?
Well, like I said, I mean, there's only a limited number of travel dollars out there, and people are more savvy than ever on how they want to spend those dollars. I mean, the internet, you can Google and you see pictures and you just where your location. So it's just you've got to compete. And I just say travelers are smarter than ever. Mm-hmm. So they want value.
Are there listings still going up? You report that there are about 2,500 listings now compared to hotel rooms in the city. That's at least 10 times that amount. Is there still room for growth?
I believe there is still room for growth as more people, you know, I know there's horror stories about Airbnb, but a lot of people have really good experiences with it, both hosting and being a traveler. So as more information gets out there, as more people, you know, do it, I would speculate that would increase because, you know, the number of people coming to visit Pittsburgh is increasing as well.
All right. In a sentence or two. So what is your takeaway from all this reporting? Are you more likely to opt for Airbnb or the like the next time you're able to get away?
Well, Kevin, I have always been an Airbnb fan. I've stayed in them in Europe. I've stayed in them all across the country. And I really only ever had one bad experience. And that was way back when it was just getting underway. And I was in Memphis and it was sort of in a sketchy neighborhood. And I didn't really understand the concept, to be honest with you, but since then I have had so many great experiences you know, everywhere I've stayed.
Gretchen McKay is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gretchen, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, President Trump delivers his State of the Union address this evening. What might it mean for Pennsylvania? And Governor Wolf unveils his sixth budget. We'll break down the key details and get reaction from Republican leadership. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.